much of the energy of the blast. Suddenly fearful that there might be another explosion, Naki turned back toward the node. At the same instant, she saw Weir's boat racing perhaps 300 meters ahead of her. He was beginning to curve and slow as he neared the impassable perimeter of the node. Naki knew that she did not have time to delay. That was when Weir saw her. His boat sped up again, arcing hard away. Naki steered immediately, certain that her boat was faster and that it was now only a matter of time before she had him. A minute later, Weir's boat disappeared around the curve of the node's perimeter. She might have stood a chance of getting an echo from his hull, but this close to the node, all sonar returns were too garbled to be of any use. Naki steered away, hoping that Weir would make the tactical mistake of striking for another node. In open water, he stood no chance at all, but perhaps he understood that as well. She had circumnavigated a third of the node's perimeter when she caught up with him again. He had not tried to run for it. Instead, he had brought the boat to a halt within the comparative shelter of an inlet on the perimeter. He was standing up at the rear of the boat with something small and dark in his hand. Naki slowed her boat as she approached him. She had popped back the canopy before it occurred to her that Weir might be equipped with the same weapons as Crane. She stood up herself. "Weir?" He smiled. "I'm sorry to have caused so much trouble, but I don't think it could have happened any other way." She let this pass. "That thing in your hand?"
"Yes."
"It's a weapon, isn't it?" She could see it clearly now. It was merely a glass bauble, little larger than a child's marble. There was something opaque inside it, but she could not tell if it contained fluid or dark crystals.
"I doubt that a denial would be very plausible at this point." He nodded, and she sensed the lifting, partially at least, of some appalling burden. "Yes, it's a weapon. A juggler killer."
"Until today I'd have said no such thing was possible."
"I doubt that it was very easy to synthesize. Countless biological entities have entered their oceans, and none of them have ever brought anything with them that the juggler couldn't assimilate in a harmless fashion. Doubtless some of those entities tried to inflict deliberate harm, if only out of morbid curiosity. None of them succeeded. Of course you can kill jugglers by brute force." He glanced toward the moat where the mushroom cloud was dissipating. "But that isn't the point. Not subtle. But this is. It exploits a logical flaw in the juggler's own informational processing algorithms. It's insidious. And no, humans most certainly didn't invent it. We're clever, but we're not that clever."
Naki strove to keep him talking. "Who made it, Weir?"
"The Ultras sold it to us in a pre-synthesized form. I've heard rumors that it was found inside the topmost chamber of a heavily fortified alien structure. Another that it was synthesized by a rival group of jugglers. Who knows? Who cares, even? It does what we ask of it. That's all that matters."
"Please don't use it, Raphael."
"I have to. It's what I came here to do."
"But I thought you all loved the jugglers."
His fingers caressed the glass globe. It looked terribly fragile.
"We?" "Crane, her delegates."
"They do. But I'm not one of them."
"Tell me what this is about, Raphael."
"It would be better if you just accepted what I have to do."
Naki swallowed. "If you kill them, you kill more than just an alien life form. You erase the memory of every sentient creature that's ever entered the ocean."
"Unfortunately, that rather happens to be the point."
Weir dropped the glass into the sea. It hit the water, bobbed under, and then popped back out again, floating on the surface. The small globe was already immersed in a brackish scum of gray-green microorganisms. They were beginning to lap higher up the sides of the globe, exploring it. A couple of millimeters of ordinary glass would succumb to juggler erosion in perhaps 30 minutes. But Naki guessed that this was not ordinary glass, that it was designed to degrade much more rapidly. She jumped back down into her control seat and shot her boat forward.
she came alongside Weir's boat, trapping the globe between the two craft. Taking desperate care not to nudge the hulls together, she stopped her boat and leaned over as far as she could without falling in. Her fingertips brushed the glass. Maddeningly, she could not quite get a grip on it. She made one last valiant effort, and it drifted beyond her reach. Now it was out of her range, no matter how hard she stretched. Weir watched impassively. Naki slipped into the water. The layer of juggler organisms licked her chin and nose, the smell immediate and overwhelming now that she was in such close proximity. Her fear was absolute. It was the first time she had entered the water since Mina's death. She caught the globe, taking hold of it with the exquisite care she might have reserved for a rare bird's egg. Already the glass had the porous texture of pumice. She held it up for Weir to see. "I won't let you do this, Raphael." "I admire your concern." "It's more than concern. My sister is here. She's in the ocean. And I won't let you take her away from me." Weir reached inside a pocket and removed another globe. They sped away from the node in Naki's boat. The new globe rested in his hand like a gift. He had not yet dropped it in the sea, although the possibility was only ever an instant away. They were far from any node now, but the globe would be guaranteed to come in contact with juggler matter sooner or later. Naki opened a watertight equipment locker, pushing aside the flare pistol and first aid kit that lay within. Carefully, she placed the globe inside, and then watched in horror as the glass immediately cracked and dissolved, releasing its poison. Little black, irregularly shaped grains, like burnt sugar. If the boat sank, the locker would eventually be consumed into the ocean, along with its fatal contents. She considered using the flare pistol to incinerate the remains, but there seemed too much danger of dispersing it at the same time. Perhaps the toxin had a restricted lifespan once it came into contact with air, but that was nothing she could count on. But Weir had not thrown the third globe into the sea, not yet. Something she had said had made him hesitate. "Your sister?"
"You know the story," Naki said. "Mina was a conformal. The ocean assimilated her entirely rather than just recording her neural patterns. It took her as a prize."
"And you believe that she's still present in some sentient sense?"
"That's what I choose to believe, yes. And there's enough anecdotal evidence from other swimmers that conformals do persist in a more coherent form than other stored patterns."
"I can't let anecdotal evidence sway me, Naki. Have the other swimmers specifically recorded encounters with Mina?"
"No," Naki said carefully.
She was sure that he would see through any lie that she attempted. "But they wouldn't necessarily recognize her if they did." "And you? Did you attempt to swim yourself?"
"The swimmer corps would never have allowed me."
"Not my question. Did you ever swim?"
"Once," Naki said.
"And?"
"It didn't count. It was the same time that Mina died."
She paused and then told him all that had happened.
"We were seeing more sprite activity than we'd ever recorded. It seemed like coincidence."
"I don't think it was."
Naki said nothing.
She waited for Weir to collect his own thoughts, concentrating on the steering of the boat. Open sea lay ahead, but she knew that almost any direction would bring them to a cluster of nodes within a few hours. "It began with the Pelican in Impiety," Weir said. "A century ago. There was a man from Zion on that ship. During the stopover, he descended to the surface of Turquoise and swam in your ocean. He made contact with the jugglers and then swam again. The second time, the experience was even more affecting. On the third occasion, the sea swallowed him. He'd been a conformal, just like your sister. His name was Ormuzd."
"It means nothing to me."
"I assure you that on his homeworld it means a great deal more. Ormuzd was a failed tyrant, fleeing a political counter-revolution on Zion. He had murdered and cheated his way to power on Zion, burning his rivals in their houses while they slept. But there'd been a backlash,